I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. It was a dramatic day of testimony in the corruption trial of Philadelphia Representative Shaka Fattah today, as a longtime political associate of the congressman tied him directly to a scheme to steal hundreds of thousands in public and charitable funds to repay an illegal campaign loan. Joining me now is WHYY's Aaron Mozell, who's covering the trial. Aaron, good evening.
Good evening, Dave.
Day three. Where are we in the trial?
So, big picture, the government's 85-page indictment can be divided into five schemes that Fattah and four associates allegedly participated in. Right now, prosecutors are currently delving into the first scheme, and that involves allegations tied to Fattah taking an illegal $1 million campaign loan while he was running for Philadelphia mayor in 2007. This is the year that ultimately put Mayor Nutter in office. And the scheme goes like this in a nutshell. It's a somewhat complicated nutshell, but just stay with me. Fattah allegedly arranges for one of his political consultants to meet with Al Lord, who is a Sallie Mae executive at the time. Lord gives the political consultant the $1 million loan, which, according to testimony, was specifically intended to help the campaign pay for airtime. We're talking about campaign ads and also other various campaign expenses. This all happens in the waning weeks before the Democratic primary, which, as listeners may know, usually crowns the next crop of lawmakers because Philly's voter rolls are just so Democratic, so blue. The campaign ends up using about $600,000 of that illegal $1 million loan. The $400,000 they don't use allegedly goes back to Lord, the Sallie Mae exec. And the rest is allegedly paid off using a for-profit and a nonprofit organization. This is where things get a little complicated. And more specifically, by allegedly stealing federal grant money and charitable donations. This is how they repay this huge sum that they don't actually have to work with.
Let's hone in then on today's testimony.
So today we heard from a lot of people. We heard from accountants, grant officers, board members. But really the headline witness here is that political consultant that I mentioned earlier. His name is Tom Lindenfeld. On the stand, Lindenfeld is directly asked about his involvement in this scheme. I should point out that Lindenfeld is one of two people who have pleaded guilty in connection to this case. And so Lindenfeld says that about 6 weeks before the Democratic primary, the campaign is in need of cash, some serious need of cash. The campaign especially needs money for those TV ads, which are so important when you're running a citywide election. And at this point, the campaign hasn't had any of those, hasn't made a splash on the airwaves. And Lindenfeld says he shares these concerns with Fattah directly. And he says that the congressman then sets up this meeting with Al Lord, that Sallie Mae executive that we keep talking about. And the two meet a couple of times. The first meeting, they don't directly discuss this loan, but on the second one, they do, and they allegedly discuss this $1 million loan to Lindenfeld's political consulting firm with the idea that it would be used to support Fattah's campaign for mayor. Lord says as much yesterday when he takes the stand yesterday. However, he tells jurors that he never discussed the loan directly with Fattah. Lindenfeld says he does tell Fattah about the arrangement. And when he asks him about how he's going to repay the loan, because Fattah is ultimately on the line here, he says no problem. And the loan is executed. Each step of the way, Lindenfeld says that Fattah either called the shots or was involved with the discussions about the loan.
We'll be looking forward to having you keep us up with proceedings each step of the way. Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Aaron Mozell. Supporters of Bernie Sanders have announced plans for a peaceful protest in Philadelphia during the Democratic National Convention if Sanders does not win the party's nomination. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that the group is still holding out hope that Sanders will be the party's standard bearer.
When Bernie Sanders supporters felt they were denied a voice at the Democratic convention in Nevada, things got ugly. The chaos has stirred fears that Sanders backers will disrupt the national convention and divide the party. Sanders supporters in Philadelphia say they'll remain peaceful, but they expect to rally at the plaza outside the Municipal Services Building in Center City. Bruce Carter of Black Men for Bernie says Sanders is the only candidate he can believe in.
I'm 100% Bernie or bust, and one thing we're doing that we found out since we've been out here, Our goal is to register every black male that's over 18 that can vote so they will have a voice in the general election, regardless of who has the nomination.
Lawrence Hurd is another member of the group who says he's only supporting Sanders and can't vote for Hillary Clinton at this point.
I feel Bernie has a lot of points that make sense for the people as a whole.
Big man, big man.
You know, but I'm confident that Bernie's going to get the nominee. I mean, things look close.
Yanné Indigo says Sanders is being undermined by superdelegates who are appointed by the party and not elected by the people.
The person who has the most pledged delegates really should be the person who wins, but that's hard to determine when the process hasn't been handled properly.
Indigo says she wants Sanders to be a third-party candidate if Democrats don't give him the nomination in July. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia Police Department is looking for more than a few good men and women. Staffing has hit a 22-year low, and in response, the department recently loosened hiring requirements in hopes of filling the gap. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the move has not been embraced by everyone, though supporters say it will open the door to many would-be recruits.
At a packed job fair at Temple University, Philadelphia Police Officer Samuel Cruz says word has gotten around.
The biggest question today was, when are you guys getting rid of the college credit?
Recently, Police Commissioner Richard Ross told City Council that there's not one variable responsible for the 6% shortfall, but nixing the 2 years of college requirement might just boost applications.
Look, I have my reservations about going backwards on an educational requirement, I'll be honest with you, but my first concern is the safety of the people who live and visit and work in the city.
And until the department can reach its full staffing of 6,500 officers, more and more districts are going to feel stretched thin, some working more hours to make up for the manpower shortage.
Police working a lot more overtime and being tired. When officers are tired, it sounds like common sense, right? They have a harder time doing their jobs. We all are stressed out. We all make more mistakes when we've been working too long.
Emily Owens is a criminology professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She says it's especially hard to maintain stable staff levels with such a big department. Most major cities have about 2 officers per 1,000 people. Philly has 4 officers per 1,000. Still, she says lowering the standards could be risky and thinks a better incentive is offering more money. Right now, the starting cop salary in Philadelphia is about $48,000 a year.
I would say that would be a good way to get more people from all neighborhoods and from all backgrounds to apply for your jobs.
About a third of big city police departments require 2 years of college. And there's debate about whether college credits really make a cop better at policing. Critics say you don't learn street smarts by sitting in a seminar. But the other side argues that more critical thinking skills can only help police. That's been the position of Pierce College, which offers a 2-year criminal justice degree. Legal Studies faculty chair Ed Miller says it's not just that the requirement change will hurt enrollment. It's also bad for communities police serve.
The lifelong learning skills and the community awareness that comes through your experience in college, I think that brings a stronger candidate to the process.
Back at the recruitment table at the job fair, Officer Cruz tells Tomas McWaters about a hiring change in lieu of the college credits.
And you're not 19 yet, or you're 19, right?
Yes, I'll be 20.
So right now, if you want to apply, I would take advantage of it because come in July, you have to be 22 to join the department.
Okay.
Police think raising the age bar from 19 to 22 will bring in more mature applicants. After the chat, McWaters told me, no matter what age, most of his friends in West Philly would never think of becoming a cop.
Because people would look at you like you're a rat or something. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's just how the neighborhood is. I can't change it within a day.
But he says he's willing to put aside the neighborhood's attitude and prove to them that the police officers you want in your community are the people from your community. It's a message the department has been pushing, too. But as UPenn's Owen says, the viral social media accounts of police shootings of unarmed black men have really turned people off.
A small number of bad officers having bad days that are caught on tape are viewed much more widely than they were 3 years ago. Right, and that gives all officers sort of a bad rap.
Antonio James of North Philly, who's considering becoming a police officer, says that's definitely true in his neighborhood.
Yeah, I know some of my friends don't want to become a cop because of what they say about us, or it's not cool to be a cop because of what they do. I see different black American people getting frisked every day and being treated like they're nothing.
But James, just like McWaters, thinks the best way to change that is from within. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Black work matters. Race, poverty, and the future of work in Philadelphia is the focus for participants at tomorrow's summit at Community College of Philadelphia. Attendees will hear from speakers, including Reverend Gregory Holston, president of OIC America. Reverend Holston, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Reverend, the summit is entitled Philadelphia Solutions to Philadelphia Poverty. Yes. And apparently there's a roster of potential solutions. So let's take them one at a time. The first is, can city assets solve poverty in Philadelphia? This is a cash-strapped city.
When we look at solutions to Philly solutions to end Philly poverty, most of the time we've looked at solutions that really only kept people in poverty or maintained them in poverty and didn't really draw them out of poverty. You know, with that as a backdrop, we try to look at things that actually can move people out of poverty. One, as you just mentioned, city assets to be used as a way of pulling people out of poverty. You said the city is cash-strapped. And well, the city is one of the poorest cities, is also one of the wealthiest cities. It's plenty of wealth in this town. The question is, how is this wealth being used?
But no one would argue that there's already a high tax burden for residents and business concerns.
I would differ on that to some degree, but I think the point we're trying to make with city assets is that you have many assets, whether it's Philadelphia Gas Works, Philadelphia, other Philadelphia entities that have large pension funds that are invested in mutual funds throughout the country, and those mutual funds and those people get the reward of those investments. We could very much take those same dollars, put them into our own public bank, much like the state of North Dakota does, to be able to pull all those resources together, put it in our own public bank, gives us the economic power to be able to stand behind smaller banks in the city so they can do more creative lending to our own citizens to start businesses.
Let's switch over to the role of education. The Philadelphia School District is also up against budget problems. Discuss the role of early childhood intervention. Of course, the new mayor, Jim Kenney, wants to see that throughout the city.
The idea of pre-K, free pre-K, quality pre-K has been proven over and over again statistically. Let me say one of the major things that we talked about, we're going to talk about at this summit, is that our manufacturing base from 1950 to 1980, we lost about 350,000 manufacturing jobs. They were called good jobs because people could go into those jobs right out of high school, walk into a plant, stay there the next 30, 40 years of their life, be able to feed their family, be able to have a house, or be able to be productive citizens in our community, really be what we call the middle class. Well, those jobs are gone now, but we're left with this service sector industry that has been adding jobs at the same time. Now, the only difference between a manufacturing job then and a service sector job now is a strong union, because the union movement is what created the manufacturing jobs to be jobs that were middle-class jobs. If we really care about ending poverty in the city of Philadelphia, we need to be a supporter of all union movements that really are trying to get the service sector to pay people the kind of wages that are not in poverty.
So weigh in on a related matter, the notion of raising the minimum wage.
That's one of the steps that has to be included in this. The movement is one for $15. $15 an hour actually takes you out of poverty.
But then what in turn do you say to business owners who say it might take individual workers out of poverty, but it takes them out of the competitive game?
Every time the minimum wage has been raised, it was raised in Seattle with up to $15. No businesses are really shutting down. Industry is moving forward. What happens is that you actually have more dollars now circulating in the community because you're paying people more money, and therefore they, in fact, don't keep the money. They spend the money and usually spend it on other businesses, and those businesses gain in wealth and prosperity.
As a member of the clergy, let's discuss the role of faith-based institutions and what more they can do to help end the cycle of poverty.
Well, we're hopeful that part of the summit will be a calling together of faith-based institutions, black, different denominations, different in faiths coming together to really say, hey, Kay, we have a certain amount of resources that we put in banks on a regular basis. Can we put them collectively in one bank that is going to dedicate itself to really giving the kinds of loans out to help end poverty in our city? So that conversation hopefully will be going on, and we'll be moving forward to actually do that.
The Poverty Summit, Philadelphia Solutions to Philadelphia Poverty, takes place tomorrow morning. Reverend Holston, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Reverend Gregory Holston, and you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Still ahead, for some archaeologists, garbage is gold.
You know, you can learn a lot from people's trash. All their secrets are in their trash.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The Museum of the American Revolution, now under construction in Philadelphia, is expected to open next year. While digging the basement for the future museum at 3rd and Chestnut Streets, archaeologists found something interesting. 12 toilet shafts. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on what they found at the bottom of the privy.
Privies are gold mines in the archaeology world. In the 18th century, Philadelphia didn't have garbage collection, so everyone just threw their trash down the outhouse shaft.
You know, you can learn a lot from people's trash. All their secrets are in their trash.
That is Rebecca Yaman. She's an urban archaeologist hired by the Museum of the American Revolution to monitor the excavation of the construction site to see if anything important pops up. What she found, among other things, were dozens of porcelain cups used to serve a drink called posset.
Posset was this horrible drink that was made out of curdled milk and alcohol. Sounds awful to me.
Yaman also found lots of pre-revolutionary redware pottery.
We realized, oh my, this is another tavern. A lot of drinking going on in Philadelphia before the Revolutionary War. But the great part about that is that's where they were arguing the revolution. You know, they were arguing about politics. They were arguing about how do we get rich? What do we do? How do we live? How do we become Americans?
The colonists did not just go to bars to discuss what it means to be American. Yaman discovered a second tavern on the block operating illegally out of someone's home, the Humphreys. There is a record that the woman of the house, Mary Humphrey, was charged with running a disorderly house.
Now, a disorderly house was an unlicensed tavern that might have prostitutes hanging around.
Among the objects found in the privy of the unlicensed tavern was a mid-18th century bowl. Inside is a picture of a merchant ship called the Tryphena, which sailed many times between Philadelphia and Liverpool. In 1765, after England passed the Stamp Act, which added more taxes to the colonists, the Tryphena carried a message from merchants in Philadelphia to merchants in England, and it asked them to press members of Parliament to repeal that act. The Stamp Act would spur the colonists toward revolution. The Museum of the American Revolution's Vice President for Collections, Scott Stevenson, says the bowl found underneath the museum will become part of the museum.
Among the topics that we will explore in there are methods of resistance that American colonists developed to try to protest things like the Stamp Act.
The excavated objects also tell a much longer story about how urban real estate changed over 250 years, from residential use to retail to light industrial to a national park. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
It's said that money cannot buy happiness, so what actually does make you happy? Well, for our commentator Leslie Handler, the answer is simple. You make your own happiness. To paraphrase a corporate slogan, just do it.
When I was a little girl, my parents brought home a puppy. It was a boxer. Like all puppies, he jumped and chewed, barked and licked. No one in our house knew how to train him. Therefore, no one ever did. The little puppy grew to be a big, unruly dog who tried to please everyone and just didn't know how. I named him Happy, which was a most appropriate name. He would go running after any distraction. We were constantly chasing Happy. My parents built the fence outside higher and higher, but Happy kept jumping it. At one point, they even chained him to a stake in the ground to stop him. It worked great. Until a neighbor called to tell us that we had a dog, a live dog, thank God, hanging over our fence. The next day, my parents told me that Happy had run away. This was their version of, we gave him away. There would be no more chasing Happy. No more of him trying to please us without knowing how. No more his looking for something better on the other side. I missed him terribly. It was one of my first lessons in unhappiness. I'd always adored dogs. The only times I've ever known dogs to be unhappy are when they are in pain, missing someone they love, or trying to escape confinement. aside from those times, happy was exactly that, happy. We humans always seem to be looking for happiness, whether we had it once and lost it, or we've never had it. Sometimes we have fleeting moments of happiness, falling in love, getting the job, the raise, the promotion. It seems like everyone I know hasn't found it. So I've been trying to figure out how I have. Perhaps it's because I'm not looking so hard for it. I'm simply happy. The two things that I believed make me happiest are accepting the things I cannot change and knowing that if I help someone else to be happy, we'll both be happy. Believe me, I don't live a charmed life. I have just as many problems as everyone else. While I don't ignore them, I do try to put the bad stuff in perspective and weigh it against the good stuff. I always let the good stuff win. Of course, I have days when everything seems to go wrong, when I'm in pain, and I do have lots of physical pain from living with cancer for 20 years. I am admittedly unhappy. When I'm not surrounded by the people I love, I am admittedly unhappy. But overall, I'm pretty damn happy in the here and now. Like my dog Happy, I try to please those around me. Like him, I'm happy just being free of pain and with the ones I love. I'm grateful for what I have, and I look forward to the experiences yet to come. Now that I'm all grown up, unlike that little girl who lost her dog, I'm no longer chasing happy. I found it right where I am. I'm Leslie Handler.
Writer and blogger Leslie Handler lives in New Jersey. You can read the thoughts of others in our region at newsworks.org/speakeasy. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Tomorrow evening, we'll look at Philadelphia's changing neighborhoods, a new report by the Pew Trusts that looks at gentrification and other shifts since the year 2000. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.